Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, the podcast for embedded Linux developers who want to simplify and speed up their custom platform development. Visit TimeSys.com today for access to our podcast archives.
Hi, welcome to Linux Link Radio, a podcast for embedded Linux developers. This is Gene Sally, and I'm here with
Maciej Halasz.
And today, first of all, sorry that we missed you over Thanksgiving. We were either out of town or eating.
Second part, definitely. Yeah, but hopefully you enjoyed your holidays as much as we did.
Yeah, I did want to record a little thing. I know we recorded something small about, sorry I missed you for Thanksgiving, and I desperately wanted to talk about, both turkey recipes and how to make proper gravy and cranberries. And then, of course, the guy from marketing is like, no, you can't talk about that. So we had to skip that episode entirely. And I know we talked about things that we're going to be talking about upcoming episodes. Like, I know we have our JTAG debugging episode coming up, and a few other things that we know that people have been writing into us about. And one of the things we wanted to tackle along that line this time around was doing kernel development and kernel, porting the kernel to a new device.
Right. I think that this is a very interesting topic to talk about because every day we all see here at TimeSys that companies, people want to port or adopt Linux for a new device. And usually there is some sort of a starting point, but there's a set of steps that one has to go through to get a Linux kernel running on a hardware that really is deployed or is used as an end product. So
sure. And a lot of that, unfortunately, is made to sound more difficult than it really is. I mean, it's one of those development chores that either it seems mysterious or is being positioned as being mysterious and extremely difficult to do. And I won't say that it's easy for a lot of tasks, but then again, it's not so hard. And as you said, if you go through some steps for many boards and for many CPUs and the CPUs that actually are the system on a chip, it's not that bad of a process, and it's something that's accomplishable without knowing some sort of magic skill.
Well, and interesting thing you mentioned, it is a process. So as long as we or you, our listeners, know the process, it should be fairly easy to adopt that process to a specific application,
sure,
to a specific porting effort.
Sure.
I agree with you that it might seem difficult, and it is in some cases.
Yeah.
Everything depends from various factors, and we're going to cover all those different assumptions and challenges that you might run into. But we want to focus on the process. We want to talk about a bit about the structure, what's needed.
Yeah.
And most likely what's going to happen is we're not going to have enough time today to cover the entire process, but hopefully we'll be able to dive into more details as to how you port the Linux kernel to a specific platform next time.
Oh, sure.
So,
I agree. There's no way we could cover this in, as we try to keep this to a half an hour, and I think there's enough material there, right? So that if we started talking about it, we could go on for an hour and a half easily, and that's much too long. I don't think we could keep someone's attention for an hour and a half, let alone break it up into something that's coherent, right? For that much time, you can keep track of. So, so let's dig in and talk about what's going on. And I think today we're going to try to get at least as far as like kernel configuration and what's involved there.
Yeah.
But it starts with, the typical question we get. So here's the question. So someone will call up and say, well, I don't even know where to start.
Right.
And so we tell those people, and they'll say, well, I can go to kernel.org, right? And I can download my kernel, right? And I can start developing on that, right?
So before we dive into that part of the process, usually people have some sort of a hardware design in mind.
Oh, that's a really good point, yeah.
They already have a board that they already have designed, or they know what their new platform is going to have.
Yeah.
In terms of peripherals, in terms of specific processor, and very often a specific reference design is used as a starting point. I mean, hardware reference design.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. Rarely does a customer, call in here, or I've talked to someone at a trade show that does not have some idea of what board they're using.
Right, because the level of effort required to adopt the Linux kernel for a brand new processor with brand new set of peripherals is completely different from adopting a reference design, a hardware reference design for a specific application. What we want to focus on today and next time is the second use case where you have a reference design that you're starting from, and you are selecting different hardware components similar to some extent to reference design.
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, if you were to start porting Linux for an entire new processor, I even doubt that's a podcastable topic, right? But so I agree. So let's start from this working from some piece of reference hardware. Mm-hmm. Let's say if you got an Atmel board or a, some sort of Freescale board or some sort of x86 something, whatchamacallit.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. As long as there's a reference board and your custom hardware, your custom design includes, some percentage of components that have been used on a reference board.
Yeah, and we see that, we see that a lot with system on a chip designs, right? So they'll take the system on a chip unchanged, right? And they'll look at the hardware and say, well, even if the hardware stays roughly the same, I'm still interested in pairing out the software that's not going to be used for this piece of hardware, right? I can't change what's going to be on that die. But when the guys fabricate the board that's actually going to go in the device, they're not going to put a head on it for a video adapter, and they're not going to put a USB head on it, and they're not going to put a serial bus head on it. So I don't need any of that. And right. So I can just take that out of my design from a software perspective, even though it's still sitting on that die.
Yeah. Today we see more than ever the adoption of system on chips rather than just processor cores. So certain applications, well, I don't think that there is a single application that would require all of the peripherals on the system on chip, but I would bet that between 70 to 90% of system-on-chip peripherals are used in applications. Otherwise, people would not select that specific processor for the design.
So let's go back. Let's go back to my start. Yeah. It's like, okay, so I have my magic board, and it's the magic board I believe is right for me, and it has my system-on-chip. Where do I go?
Right. Well, that's a good question, because I guess the question that is following that, where do I go and what do I need, is what are the components that I should care about when I start thinking about porting Linux to my custom board, right? So Linux kernel for sure.
Okay.
And you need to have a starting point as far as good Linux kernel device drivers are concerned.
Yeah.
But you also need another piece of software, which is a toolchain to cross-compile the Linux kernel and be able to verify that your port is working, right? So what do you get the first one?
So you mean
the Linux kernel?
The Linux kernel. Well, I'd imagine best place to go, and a lot of people, depending upon what board you have, is to go to kernel.org and pick out what the latest release is, download it, and see if your board has support for it inside the Linux kernel. And that's a question that's sort of a stinker question. So some people say, well, how do I know if my board's supported? And I always go and do a find for, asterisk def config asterisk and see what pops up, right? Because, the scheme so far is it's board name underscore def config, and that's placed under the architecture directory. So, you should know what kind of, but if you don't know what architecture that your board is, that's an indicator, maybe you should get a consultant, right, to do the work for you, right? But typically, you know the architecture, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're usually clueful enough to know what the architecture is, and then that way you can just run find and see what def configs pop up, right?
Well, so that's one way of doing that, but def configs do not exist for all boards that are currently on the market, and the support for device drivers and specific platforms that's in a kernel mainline. In most cases, does not include support for all device drivers that are on a reference platform, right? From a semi vendor. So another source for a Linux kernel is semi vendor itself, right?
Yeah.
They today what we see is that most semi vendors do have a Linux engineering team that does the Linux enablement on their processors and reference platforms, and usually the Linux that is available from Semi, even though it might not be based on the latest Linux kernel, will include support for most, if not all, device drivers that are present on the reference.
Kernel. Well, I know there's a great, among the Semi vendors that we work with, there's a great push, right, to get that into the Linux mainline, because they don't want to be maintaining these branches of Linux. It's just not, it's not what they do for a living. And but I do agree that sometimes you don't get that board support, or peripheral support in the kernel mainline.
So you
still may want to go with what's on kernel.org, because because the core of the kernel is much more current, and then you simply have to sort of patch forward or move forward the drivers that are specific to that board, and that can get into some work.
So this is actually a topic that I wanted to spend a minute on, which is why would you care about the latest Linux kernel? versus a Linux kernel that's, let's say, five versions older that comes from a semi-vendor and has support for a number of device drivers. So my answer to that question would be that, well, it depends from your hardware, custom hardware design. If you're using only a small subset of device drivers that are present on a reference card, or device drivers that are quite well supported by the mainline, it probably makes more sense to start with a kernel mainline, because of all the work that is being done by open source community around fixes and re-implementation performance improvements to the core kernel functionality and behavior, right? And I would imagine that most customers would prefer to begin with the latest kernels to take advantage of those fixes, implementations, and well.
Oh yeah. Well, the other artifact that you see in the embedded Linux community is, right, so once someone will pick a Linux kernel, there is a very high resistance to switching to another version.
And so
whenever you're doing something like open source, you're saying the Linux kernel has the head of line has all the most changes and has, you know, all the core architecture changes and a lot of stability changes and security changes. I mean, you want to start with those as your starting point if you're of the mind that you're not going to be changing kernel versions as your project progresses. And I know a lot of people are in that camp where they say, okay, I've picked, you know, 2.6 Mumble, and I'm using 2.6 Mumble forever, and I will never change from that. And any patches have to come against that version. Or any changes have to come as patches against that version, and I might not even take those.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, but I would see the process, and so the process that we're talking about would be such that when you begin your project, you would probably want to take advantage of all the latest code that's available at that time. But once you are fairly far along in your porting efforts, or you have a Linux kernel tested running on the platform, at that point you probably would not want to introduce any changes or any significant changes, because you have a working solution already. Right?
Yeah, and then that means at the starting point there's some reconciliation effort between, say, okay, I got my 2.6, pick some number from my board vendor that has, you know, these four device drivers, and I think we'll talk. I don't know if we'll make it in this podcast, but the later podcast, about how you actually shift those around, right?
Right.
But they have these, you know, four particular drivers. Those are the ones that I need. And then I need to get those working. I need to take those. I need to set them up either as patches or modules that I compile, you know, outside of my kernel tree for this newer version. I need to get them to work and validate that, you know, even if they do compile, right? That's, that does not mean working, right? So you need to at least make sure for so that, you know, they both compile and function as expected for the board. And that's sort of this starting point that you need to account for and budget for time-wise, that even if you get, you know, a Linux kernel that works from your board vendor, most likely you're going to be doing some minimal amount of reconciliation between head of line for the kernel and whatever device drivers happen to come in from the board vendor. And maybe even some satisficing. I think that's a word. There's some satisficing involved.
You know, what does it mean?
You know what? You sort of live with something. You're not entirely happy with your choice, but it's the choice you feel like you had to make, because that's just how things worked out. Because you may have to do some satisficing, because the board vendor may have picked, you know, 2.6 Mumble, you know, for its 2.6.18, because it couldn't get the drivers to work on the newer version of the kernel.
Yeah, make sure that you add it to Wikipedia.
You know that. Anyways, that's actually a word.
Okay, so we talked about the Linux kernel so far, and we mentioned two sources for the Linux kernel, right? Do you see any other sources where people could get the Linux kernel from?
There's a couple industry sites out there, right? And I know, and you know, I'm hesitant to make, because I know one of them that handle the partners orgs is sort of going away, and so I'm hesitant to, you know, to start rattling off a list that's probably be wrong. But I know a lot of folks, but I'll try one, right? So a lot of people hit PPC Linux. I can't say it.
Got it.
And there's one dedicated to the AT91s as well. Mm-hmm. And so those generally contain some patches that are specific for a certain board. Sometimes vendors will support their own patches for their own board as well on their site. But those are the two that come to my mind as being industry open sites.
Okay, so we have identified three kind of major sources for the Linux kernel, mainline, semiconductor vendor, and then open source projects that care about specific feature functionality or a specific board. And it might be a combination of the three to get you actually a good running solution.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely a three-way merge, I think, in order to get what you're happy with. Assuming you want to do the all open source thing.
So that's the Linux kernel. But you did talk about the fact that you want to compile the Linux kernel.
Maybe. You don't want to start doing it. Maybe not.
I think that if you want to check if your changes actually are valid and they work, you do need a compiler. Right? But
okay, you might talk to me into that. I don't know. Yeah, but you're right. You do need a cross compiler. No doubt about it.
So where do you take it from?
Well, I don't know. You go to the cross-compiler tree that grows in the backyard. No, you know what a lot of people do is they get their cross-compiler from, sometimes they pick it up off the vendor. Sometimes the board vendor, you know, is an enablement way. They'll ship you some version of GCC, right, to compile with. Or you can, you know, cross-compile your own, right? And you can use it. There's a couple projects out there for that that are reasonable. You have the cross-tool project from Dan. The last name begins with K. I can't remember his last name ever. And then there's the build root project, too, that'll build you a reasonable cross-compiler. Sometimes, right? And both of those projects are reasonable projects in order to create a cross-compiler. Mm-hmm. Or you can just man up and build one from scratch, from GCC.
Or you can buy one from somebody.
Oh, yeah. You can go out and buy one. That's actually turning into a, if you look at the market landscape, maybe that's in lines with satisficing, right? But if you look at what's happening out there in the market, that's a growing area because it's a pain in the butt, right? To get a tool chain that works, that's new. Right, those three things put together really is
well new and actually well optimized for the processor that you care about, and cross tool chain that will do a decent job in getting you a nice binary image for the Linux kernel application development, because you want to actually do the development of your Linux kernel and your entire system using. Well, it's not required, but recommended that you use the same cross tool chain or tool chain to cross compile everything.
Oh yeah, you should be doing that. But when you say it's like well optimized, I'm making quotes with my fingers. Well optimized for,
I can see that.
What does that mean?
Well,
sell me a well optimized tool chain.
Oh well, I will talk about specific use case, and hopefully that will provide enough.
It might.
Grounds for that case, but let's say that you take a new core that was developed by a semi that has certain instruction words that provide additional acceleration, hardware acceleration for certain features. To take full advantage
of
those.
Hardware acceleration for what features?
I don't know. It can be a hardware acceleration for you got me.
I just want to understand.
Well, it can be a hardware acceleration for
floating point stuff.
Floating point, or let's say offload from a bus somehow.
Some of them have like integrated like instructions that's like shuttle stuff off to some DSP to do something and then wait.
If you have a DSP available on the same platform, but in most cases, when you design a core or system on chip, there are certain internal. Areas, in the design of the core that make the communication with an external word much faster, right? So you have a bus and a system on chip and different peripherals loaded on the same, are connected to the same bus. But the core itself can process different words for multimedia, for example, in a certain way that the video, you get better video processing in connection with memory access.
Oh, so there might be a specific instruction to shuffle data around on memory through the bus, through whatever it uses for its front side bus that requires less processing cycles on the processor. Ah, okay. So now I understand.
Okay. So with those optimizations in the cross tool chain, you can make sure that, there's, I guess, another area that got recently added to PowerPC processors, some of them, which is security what is it called? The codecs of different types. And so those additional hardware features are available, but you need to, in order to take advantage of them, you need additional code in the Linux kernel. I'm not sure if there's any requirement for the cross tool chain.
Okay. But there's a certain instruction that's generated for that. Or someone wrote assembly somewhere that has a specific instruction built into it that if you can't, right? So the assembler will come by and say, oh, by the way, I don't know what that opcode does.
Right.
Ah, okay.
Talking about the cross-tool chain and the source for the cross-tool chain, you can probably get a decent cross-tool chain that's generic for ARM architecture or PowerPC architecture that will probably allow you to cross-compile your Linux kernel code.
Okay.
And a lot of, PowerPC cross-tool chains are backwards compatible in a way that you can use a PowerPC 7xx cross-tool chain with other sub-architectures in a PowerPC family.
So this is like something I think that most people really miss on, right? Because even if you go out and get a tool chain, right, that develops that generates code that works for your processor, it doesn't mean it's generating necessarily the best code. And you could have all kinds of unused, right, performance features or security features sitting on this processor that, because the compiler never knows to generate the correct instruction sets for it, just never get used. It's like you're buying processor that because you don't have the right software enablement.
For security, I guess it would be primarily in a Linux kernel code, but and the compiler would provide certain functionality, but it wouldn't be up to a performance level that the processor was designed for, right? So you wouldn't be able to take full advantage of hardware if you're not using a well-optimized cross-tool chain.
Yeah, that makes sense. So that means you're having all that money going. But, I mean, you're paying more for that chip design, right?
Right.
But because you don't have the enabling software, it just goes to waste.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I think a lot of people fall into that trap. Like, oh, geez, I have my ARM11, my ARM11 processor. It generates the right codes. Things run. And yet, because it's not really taking advantage of everything on the chip, they're not getting the most out of that processor.
Yeah. I think that we are kind of like a segue right now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's good. But let's go back to a topic of where you get the cross tool chain from and how to find the best tool chain for the task that I'm going to perform.
Sure.
Right. And my task is I'm porting the Linux kernel for my new processor or new board. So you mentioned several open source projects.
Yeah.
In most cases, because the cross-tool chain is such a difficult task to build, I mean, it takes a lot of effort to assemble on your own an appropriate cross-tool chain that would also include all the optimizations in it. A lot of customers that I talk to, and probably same case with you, they prefer to get a cross-tool chain from a trusted source. And there are several places where you can get or purchase or get some sort of a cross-tool chain for optimized for a specific family of processors.
Sure.
So with that tool chain, the question is, what is my development environment? Where do I install it? Are there cross-tool chains available for, Linux for sure, but Windows, for example,
how do I
do that?
Yeah, I know a lot of people, it's weird because it's sort of region dependent, right? Some regions are very Windows oriented, where a lot of the development work still happens on Windows platforms. And that always struck me as being odd because I just thought there's a lot of efficiencies right behind using Linux as your development platform. But you have to look out. I mean, you have to have your head, you have to have your things oriented, you're thinking correctly because, even if you manage to find a cross tool chain, it doesn't necessarily mean it'll be one that executes on Windows. And if you get into the "I'm going to build my own tool chain" route, which is it's an okay thing to do. If you want to go buy one, it's okay to build your own. Having that cross compile on Windows is its own adventure, right? There's actually two problems to solve at that point. One is making sure that it has the correct instruction set, it's generating the right code for the target processor, and the other thing is it has the fixes in place to handle whatever variations occur because you're using Cygwin. You're right. You have to pick an environment. I've even found a lot of folks on Windows that don't want to cross that hurdle. Mm-hmm. Will just run a VM on their Windows machine and run Linux and run Linux inside of that.
Well, but I guess that a lot of times I hear the question: is my end user experience going to be similar to the one of when I use Windows host compared to Linux host? Will I be able to perform exactly the same tasks, or will I be constrained in any ways in trying to adopt the Linux kernel for my hardware, right? Mm-hmm. So in a lot of times, companies actually look at it and in scenarios where, Linux as an operating system is new to a company.
Yeah.
And so far they've been using other operating systems. They have experience in embedded space, but using other solutions. And in doing the development, they do have experience or they have used so far only a Windows-based host development environment, it is to some extent a challenge, right? And you want to manage your risks, but at the same time, you want to leverage the expertise and experience that you have in-house.
Yeah.
So the answer to the question whether you can work equally well under Windows is yes. The challenges in getting an cross-region for Windows environment that comes from an open source.
Sure. Right?
So because it takes a lot of effort to build a cross-toolchain in general, but mm-hmm. building a cross-toolchain that runs under Windows in some way is even more difficult.
Sure.
So getting it a toolchain like that from an open source is a bit difficult, and I haven't seen too many of places where you could get such a toolchain from, but you can get it from different vendors, and I'm sure that there's one or two places in the open source that you can find a toolchain like that.
Sure.
Perhaps for the next installment of that of this topic, we can bring up some of examples. I mean, some of the open source projects where you could get such a cross toolchain.
Yeah, but we'll just imagine. Let's just say that to keep things moving along, so we're not boring people to no end, as usual. So. Let's pretend all of a sudden by magic, the toolchain stork has come by, dropped off a toolchain that does in fact work, right? And it's appropriate for the board, and it's appropriate for the processor, and it's the perfect toolchain.
Yeah.
Then what?
What kind of toolchain do you need? That's the next question, right?
Okay.
Because
the stork dropped off the perfect toolchain.
Well, if you don't do application development at this stage and you want to just port the Linux kernel, the thing is that you don't need any libraries in your cross toolchain. All you need is the bare bone toolchain that has GCC, binutils, and that's it.
Right? Does it use a linker?
I
think it uses a linker too.
It does use a linker.
I guess it's in binutils, right?
But it's in the binutils. So the point is that you don't need C libraries because Linux kernel being autonomous compared to applications mm-hmm. Relies on its own implementations of different symbols. So if you do printfs in kernel, that will be a printk, and all of those symbols are implemented inside the kernel.
Yeah, I do agree. There is no relationship between whatever libc you're using. As a matter of fact, there's not only no relationship, but there's not even, like you said, it's not even necessary that libc exists with your toolchain.
Yeah.
But then, then again, I don't mean to get off into toolchain, whatever. But it takes a lot of effort, I think, to build a toolchain without the libc, right? I mean, that's. Mm. I mean, if you think about the way the scripts are structured, that gets kind of hard,
right?
Right. If you go,
so I'm not sure if I agree, but
that's okay.
I want you to actually dive a bit more into that segue.
So that's a good point. So let's say you follow the scripts out of if you get cross tool or the they're pretty much set up so that you can't build
right.
They build all that in one shot, and they may stop along the way, but if you want to short circuit it and not build your libc, that's an entirely sort of a
nice, a
different way of doing that. Yeah. I think the route that you were going, like, hey, if you're just using if you're doing it the manual way completely, yeah, I'll give you there. I mean, that's just one less step to perform because libc is compiled independent of the compiler. You can use your first stage compiler and you'll be set.
Yes, but at the same time, certain applications require some other C libraries like newlib.
Yeah.
Or other small footprint implementations of C library. So if an open source project that you are working with does not support a specific library that you want to take advantage of, don't be discouraged. I mean, you can continue that search in parallel to
With your kernel development.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we'll just say, we'll go back and just pretend the compiler stork dropped off whatever was right.
Okay. So assuming that we have right now our development environment in place, right? Because you don't need, I don't think, anything else installed on your host machine to do the Linux kernel development, right? I'm looking at your face right now.
Okay.
All right. So got agreement. So we have a Linux kernel. We have a cross-toolchain. What's next? Let's talk a bit about the internal structure of the Linux kernel.
Sure.
And introduce some concepts that will be important for the next installment and when we talk in more detail about what you have to adjust in the Linux kernel. the first thing that comes to my head is the fact that kernel has two distinctive spaces. There's an app user space and a kernel space.
Sure.
And when you do a Linux kernel port, what you're concerned with is primarily the kernel space.
Sure.
User space provides the connection to a C library, for example, via system calls, right? So that's how user applications can control or talk to specific device drivers. Uh-huh. But once the system call is dispatched into a Linux kernel space, what happens there, is a different story.
Sure.
So let's talk about different blocks of functional blocks that are implemented in a Linux kernel.
Okay.
Can you start with that?
Well, I mean, the first one you have, right, that most people run across, right, is a file system block.
Yeah.
And that's typically what they spend a lot of time on. Mm-hmm. And then there's also...
Why do they spend a lot of time on file system
blocks? Oh, my goodness. So for embedded systems, most people pick a different file system. Right. And well, in fact, when the Linux kernel is shipped in its default configuration, not the ship, but whenever you get in its default configuration, it usually has, you know, several file systems built in, all of which take up a lot of memory, right? And right. So, you know, one of the first jobs you do is clip out the file systems you're not using.
Right.
And then you also usually clip out the peripheral devices you're not using, the other bus devices.
So I agree with you that file system support is very crucial mm-hmm. in a Linux kernel, because without file system, you're not going to be able to boot the Linux kernel all the way up, right? But this is also a piece of, part of the Linux kernel code, core to the Linux kernel,
yeah.
that most likely you won't have to touch when you port the Linux kernel to your custom hardware. You'll have to probably reconfigure the kernel to enable, disable some support for certain file systems, but you don't have to, you won't most likely have to adjust the code itself.
Well, and that's probably like a good thing to talk about, right? Because, you know, the difference between going in and running configure, right? Because when I talk about clipping out, right? I'm really talking about running configure and getting rid of things that I'm not interested in.
Okay.
And I think you're talking about, hey, I'm going to open up this device driver here and get rid of things I don't need, or otherwise adjust things so that they function correctly.
So I agree that this is a two-tier approach, that there's a configuration approach, and then there is a down to the level of a source code involvement, right?
Sure.
Where you have to modify certain code, write device drivers, modify device drivers, attach some C files inside the Linux kernel source tree.
Yeah.
But let's just quickly do a run through functional blocks of the Linux kernel.
Sure.
Just to build that layer. So there's file system support.
Yeah.
There is
memory management, the big MM spot, right?
Well, yes, there's a process management, mm-hmm. right, which is more of a scheduler approach where you schedule different tasks as they execute. You mentioned memory management.
Yeah.
And memory management is divided into several functional pieces, there mm-hmm. some which are hardware independent and some that are hardware dependent.
Sure.
And that will actually apply to most of the internals inside the Linux kernel, except for file systems, right? But when you talk about memory management, that relies heavily on having a memory management unit attached to your CPU.
Oh, yeah.
And with the power management, for example, you want to have some of the hardware peripherals to support good power management handling. There's a device control. There's networking. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about networking or devices, there are several types of device drivers that are available in Linux kernel, right? There are, and you can see all of those when you bring up the kernel configuration screen.
Okay.
But there are network device drivers, there are character device drivers,
yeah.
and there are block device drivers, mm-hmm. right? So those are the three major types of device drivers that you will find in the Linux kernel. And a lot of devices like console, video device drivers, they actually all fork off those types of block or character device drivers or network device drivers. And then there's also the core kernel implementation that provides support for a specific processor, a specific CPU. Right. So when a semi-vendor introduces a new processing core to the marketplace, they usually also provide a part of the Linux kernel source tree that provides support for that processor, for that processing unit, for that core. And this is important because if you were to write that piece of the Linux kernel code on your own, I think it would be a much more difficult task to perform, right? Because this is really a lot of code. This is initialization. This is how the instructions are being handled by the processor. So those are more or less functional pieces that you would find inside the Linux kernel. And again, they are divided into hardware-dependent and hardware-independent pieces. Mm-hmm. There are also parts of the Linux kernel code that are architecture and processor-specific.
Sure.
Device drivers, however, are not necessarily associated with a specific processor or architecture. So they can be reused on multiple architectures.
Yeah, so just when things got fun, so we have to, we're like 10 minutes over our time limit.
So, oh my goodness.
So
You're a talker, Gene.
No. I always say we have to stop talking, but it's more appropriate that you have to stop talking because I don't think I've been contributing anything the past a couple minutes.
Yeah. No. Okay. So
my eyelids were closing and stuff. I mean, that was.
That means that stuff that I'm talking resting, about is not.
I was just resting
that
my
interesting,
eyes.
Huh?
Yeah, I was just resting my eyes.
Okay. So, I agree that we don't want to take too much of your time. And we did schedule another.
Oh yeah.
Recording session to continue on the topic of porting Linux kernel to a custom hardware.
Sure.
So I think this is a good stopping point.
Sure.
We'll take it from there next time.
Yeah. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to write into us, podcast@timesys.com. Mm-hmm. I did get one note. It was interesting. So someone wrote in and they were said, you know, you won't refer to me, you won't put me on a mailing list or anything like that. So if you do write in, don't be afraid. We won't stick a salesman on you or anything like that or put you on some spam list we have to tolerate for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Gene actually might call you, but that's a different story.
Well, we do write back though, right?
Yes, we do.
So if you write in, we do our best to write back to you. But yeah, I said it was actually for more than one person. So I've heard from several people. It's like, well, I didn't want to write in because I was afraid that I would be put on a spam list for the rest of my life. Which is, we promise we won't do that. So
Yeah. Feel
free to write in with your questions or comments. We do get a lot of email, and we do our best to respond. But sometimes we don't, and if we don't, I'll apologize. I'm sorry.
So. Today, thank you very much for your attention and time, and we'll continue on the topic next time.
Yeah, tomorrow, next time we're digging into what we're going to be digging into, creating device drivers, right? And more lower level stuff, right?
Absolutely.
Great. Okay, see you then.
Thanks.
Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Are you new to embedded Linux? Looking for a way to simplify your next project? The Linux Link service by TimeSys makes it easy to build your custom embedded Linux platform. Go to timesys.com today or call 866-392-4897 to learn more.